You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Over the past 6 months, we've taken a look at the nuts and bolts at the increasingly dysfunctional relationship between the president, the Congress, and the workings of our government. With a new deal that has the potential to get through Congress but does not fund the wall that President Trump has demanded, tonight we take a look at what to expect. Will the government be shut down? Will the president declare a state of emergency or simply find funds somewhere else in the budget? What powers and limitations are there to his powers which might be implicated by such actions? If you have a question for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio tonight is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the local dialing area, again, that's outside of San Francisco, please call on our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. With me tonight, we're fortunate to have with us Jamal Anderson. Jamal has served as a Deputy San Mateo District Attorney since 2014. Prior to becoming an attorney, Jamal worked for a number of elected officials in Washington, D.C., where he lived for some 10 years, including Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, as she transitioned the last time from being Minority Leader to being Speaker, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, and Congresswoman Gwen Moore. Jamal also served as Federal Affairs Advisor to the former Mayor of Washington, D.C., Adrian Fenty, and worked on the 2004 campaign, presidential campaign, of Governor Howard Dean. Dean Johnson is an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and on radio on both legal and political matters. He's also the founder of Pundit Network. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, that number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And with that, let me welcome each of you. Dean, Jamal, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, Jeff, a pleasure to be here, as always.
It's good to be back, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
You know, once again, I find myself asking, you know, with so many developments happening, you know, I wonder where we can start. But I'd like to start with this. The president's inferred that we're on the brink of a national emergency. So I guess my first question is, just what does that mean? Are we heading to martial law? Will we have troops taking over the border and building a wall? Exactly what does that mean?
Well, Jeff, first of all, let's not panic. Right now, as we sit here, as we speak, the United States is in the midst of 31 concurrent declared national emergencies. There's even a law that covers it called, of all things, the National Emergencies Act, and it sets forth the procedures by which a president can declare a national emergency and Congress can limit his power to continue funding whatever he needs to fund to fight that national emergency. Historically, presidents, very good presidents, have declared national emergencies, which have led to, in some cases, actually saving the republic. In the case of Abraham Lincoln, when the Civil War broke out, he blockaded seaports. He expanded the military. Lincoln was very candid. He said, "You know what I'm doing is probably illegal, and if you want to indict me after the war is over, that's fine." And of course, Congress ratified everything that he did. National emergencies have, however, also led to some of the darkest moments of American society. During World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt asserting emergency powers ordered Japanese Americans interned in camps. After 9/11, George W. Bush leveraged a declaration of national emergency into implementing wireless wiretaps of American citizens. So there's a whole range, but we do have a procedure in place. I suspect that we will be talking about the details of those procedures a lot as things unfold, because I think that is the route that Donald Trump is going down. And this national emergency declaration is qualitatively different, and that's the reason we're talking about it. It's qualitatively different because, first of all, by any rational measure, there is no emergency. There is the immigration crisis that exists in Donald Trump's alternative universe, where people are pouring over our southern border intent upon committing all sorts of horrendous crimes, just isn't happening.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. He was at the border just, what, was it 2 days ago?
Yeah.
Did he happen to witness anybody jumping over the border or climbing across the wall or swimming across the Rio Grande while he was there?
No, it wasn't happening because that's not happening. In fact, immigration across the southern border is down since Donald Trump was elected. It's down to one of its lowest rates since 2000. Net immigration from Mexico and Latin American countries is actually negative. The people who do come across the border and live here, whether they are documented or undocumented, commit fewer crimes per capita than pretty much any other segment of our population. So there is no crisis. Even if there was a crisis, it's not an emergency, because the whole idea behind emergency legislation and national emergency laws is that sometimes the time factor is such that the president must act to avoid an existential crisis in the United States before Congress, which acts relatively slowly, has an opportunity to do what it's supposed to do. Obviously, that time factor is not present here. Even if there were an immigration crisis, it's not something that qualifies as an emergency. So this is something very, very different. This is not about an immigration crisis. What this really is, in my opinion, is a power struggle between our institutions, between the White House, the executive branch, and between and the legislative branch. And ultimately, that's what it will come down to.
You know, you took the words out of my mouth, because what I had printed out in front of me was that the examples you had said earlier not only involved wartime, a wartime that really posed an existential threat. We had the Civil War, which could have torn the Union at least into two pieces, if not worse. We had World War II, which was, again, an external threat from abroad that would threaten the continued existence of not only the United States, but the entire Western world was potentially going to fall into a dictatorship from one of a couple external sources. This is obviously somewhat different. And I guess my question would be, what would a state of emergency likely entail in a case such as this, where we have the political reality, somebody using it to try to exert more power than that one branch of government might otherwise have? But on the other hand, you know, what would we expect from something like this? And what are the limits of presidential powers to declare such an emergency or to execute it?
Well, there are definite limits in the National Emergency Act. The president has virtually unfettered discretion to decide that there is a national emergency. But as soon as he does that, he has to do two things. First of all, he has to specify which of the many statutes that afford the executive emergency powers, and there are about 470 of them, which statute he is relying upon to designate this particular situation as an emergency. And secondly, he has to notify both houses of Congress. Once he's done that, the national emergency continues for a year unless one of several things happens. First of all, the president declares that the national emergency is over. Or secondly, if a joint resolution of Congress decides to override the president, in which case the joint resolution goes to the president's desk, he signs it or not, and then Congress is in a position where they get to decide whether they're going to override that veto or not. And that is where the real institutional battle, I think, will occur if this national emergency is declared.
Did you want to add anything to that? We've been talking a little bit about the nuts and bolts, but obviously the politics of such an emergency are quite inflamed. Where do you see Congress going?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think it's worth taking a step back to sort of figure out how we ended up in this position in the first place and why we are talking about a national emergency. I'm sure as listeners will recall, we had a government shutdown for 35 days, impacting 800,000 federal employees and thousands of other federal contractors. And the genesis of the shutdown was essentially the president rejecting what had been a bipartisan deal reached with Republicans and Democrats in both the House and the Senate to keep the government open. They decided to include in a bill almost $2 billion worth of funding, not specifically for a wall, but for border security. And after Democrats regained control of the House, or at least were triumphant in the election, the president decided that he was going to make an issue of wall funding. And so he did what he said he would do when he sat in the Oval Office with Nancy Pelosi, and he essentially facilitated the shutdown of the government. Of course, that proved to be an ineffective strategy. The government was reopened, but there was a timeline within which Congress needed to act. And so here we are with funding set to expire on Friday. Both chambers of Congress have come together and reached what seems to be a bipartisan resolution, which does not include funding specifically for the president's wall. In fact, it includes less money for border security than was included in the resolution at the end of the first shutdown. But by all accounts, it appears that no one wants another government shutdown, including the president of the United States. And so he has indicated that he is likely to sign whatever compromise is reached, which hopefully will be voted on tomorrow. But as Dean indicated, this is a substantively different issue. And I seem to believe that even if the president does sign this legislation, the prospect of a national emergency declaration is still fairly high because the politics are such that the president needs to do all that he can to solidify his base in the run-up to the 2020 election. We are in the midst of a presidential campaign. We've got multiple declared presidential candidates. And so I do believe that we may very well see a national emergency declaration. And of course, the limitations that Dean has mentioned are important.
Well, I think Jamal is essentially correct. The shutdown cost both sides an enormous amount of political capital. Neither members of Congress nor the White House wants to go through that again. So what I see is the president signing the compromise bill, which is ironically even worse than what was offered earlier. But that's only the beginning. That's not the end. This is a test of power. And, of course, Trump will accept the $1.375 billion that's allocated for fencing along the border. But he's going to go further. The first step will be that there are always pockets of money available that are discretionary to the president, and he's going to find those. But I don't think that's going to amount to anything like enough to build a wall. At that point, his choice is to declare a national emergency or not. And I believe he will, because, first of all, that's the only way he's going to get his wall built. But the wall is not the issue here. The issue is the relative power of the two branches of government. And if the president can do what is being proposed here, if he can simply override Congress's budget and take money from any number of funds, and as I mentioned, there are 470-some different statutes that allow him to do that, just because he and Congress disagree on a matter of policy, then his power becomes almost unlimited, and the power of the legislative branch shrinks proportionately. And that's what's really concerning everyone here, both Republicans and Democrats. If Donald Trump can do this, his power is going to expand beyond that of any executive we've seen probably in the history of the Republic, which has to be a frightening prospect for people who don't support Trump, but Republicans can see down the road as well. They can see over that event horizon, and they can say, well, what happens if we set that precedent now, and 8 years later or 10 years later, we're faced with a Democratic president who doesn't agree with us on policy. Is that same invocation of national emergency going to apply to a Democratic president?
I think the long-term implications politically that Dean has mentioned are important. But I would also say that the short-term implications of the president declaring a national emergency have not been lost on congressional Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, who has said quite clearly that he would not like to see the president declare a national emergency, in part for the very reason that Dean mentioned a moment ago. Once the president declares that national emergency, the House may vote on a resolution disapproving of that declaration. It is what would be referred to as a privileged resolution, which is to say that Mitch McConnell will be unable to prevent that resolution from coming up for a vote in the Senate. And Mitch McConnell does not want the members of his caucus to have to take a vote on what the president has indicated is his number one domestic priority. It would put them in a very difficult position given the opposition that's been indicated by Democrats.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco, where we are discussing National Emergency 2019. I'm Jeff Hayden. In the studio with me, looking at the potential for an upcoming declaration of emergency, Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on both television and radio of both legal and political matters, and Jamal Anderson, who has extensive experience on Capitol Hill before serving as a deputy San Mateo County District Attorney. While we may be speaking about certain specific areas, you can call regarding any question related to the topic we're discussing. You're not limited to the point in the discussion we are, or jumping in on the last line that we've discussed. Again, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, and that's anywhere outside of San Francisco, please use our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. A caller has given us a question that I think bears reading. And again, for those calling in, you can ask a question and have it read aloud if you don't want to stay on the line. You don't have to be on the radio yourself. This caller had asked, given that the president's emergency declaration is generally given great deference in the past, and given that the likely current composition of the Supreme Court, isn't it likely that the President Trump's emergency declaration is likely to be upheld?
Yeah, that's a very good question and a very insightful question, and I think the answer is yes. There's a large body of federal litigation law, federal procedure law, that deals with what we call non-justiciable issues. And one big subset of non-justiciable issues is what we call the political question doctrine. And the political question doctrine says this, that there are just certain things, certain issues that are committed to either the legislature or to the executive branch, or possibly both, that the court is simply not equipped to decide. For instance, you would never ask a court to decide, should we withdraw from Syria, or what should the marginal tax rate be? And this is one of those questions. When the president declares a national emergency, he's acting in the area that's really the president's wheelhouse, which is the area of international relations. And on top of that, Congress has long since worked out a procedure for dealing with any disputes and disagreements that they may have with the president, namely that if they don't believe there is a national emergency, they can vote on a joint resolution, send it to the president for signature. If he vetoes it, then if they have enough votes, they can override that veto and stop the national emergency altogether. So in all likelihood, if a federal court were presented with the question of, well, is this a national emergency? Did the president properly declare an emergency? They'd say, you know what, ladies and gentlemen of the Congress and the White House, you folks have to fight this out yourself. This is just not the kind of thing that, that courts do. So the effect would be, yes, up to uphold the president's decision.
I think Dean is basically correct, and the person who wrote the question has hit on something that is very important. I would say, however, that it probably is a closer call. I do think the primary point is that whatever happens, we are likely to see a significant amount of litigation. And it's my sense that that litigation is unlikely to be resolved before the 2020 election. There are, however, other complicating questions about who has standing in this particular case, members of Congress, other individuals who are impacted and affected. But I do think it is important to think through what this president has done over the course of his presidency. And I specifically recall and encourage folks to think back to the president's travel ban. This is a president who seems willing to cross political lines and deal with the consequences later. And so politically speaking, there really is no downside for the president to declare this emergency. He would, on the one hand, be providing support for what his supporters have asked him to do, what he campaigned on. And he can go out on the campaign trail and say, look, I did everything that I needed to do to get this wall, and now we're going to let the courts deal with it.
So this is reminiscent of a judge that I appeared in front of years ago with numerous motions in front of him, and his response to some was, I don't want to decide this issue. I want you two to go outside and work it out amongst yourselves. With that in mind, let me turn the question back to you, Jamal. The obvious follow-up to this is if the courts say, President, Congress, you guys got to work this stuff out, what can we expect from the Congress? Now, the House has clearly going to state an opposition to the president. But what do we expect in the Senate? If the president declares an emergency, do you think there's enough votes in the Senate to first pass the joint resolution? But secondarily, do you think there's enough votes to override what would he expect as a presidential veto?
I think to your first question, I do think there would be enough votes in the Senate. I mean, based on the numbers, we would only need – or I should say there would only need to be four Republican votes to go the other way to join all of the Democrats for a disapproval resolution. The harder question becomes overriding the president's veto, which would inevitably be a veto, which requires 67 votes in the Senate. That requires a shift of about 14 Republican senators. That obviously is a much – steeper burden. And so I suspect that, you know, if we do see this go through the judicial process and have it kicked back to the House and to the Senate, I don't know that we would necessarily see an override. But I think there is a larger issue here, and that really has to do with a broader question about divided government and the extent to which an administration should grant some semblance of deference to what the Congress has indicated its wishes are. The Congress, as I indicated at the top, on a bipartisan basis, clearly communicated that it did not have the stomach to fund a wall. And when I was here last in December, we talked very briefly about the fact that for essentially 2 years, the president's party controlled both the White House and the House and in the Senate. And during that time period, there was no appetite to provide funding for a wall. And in addition to there being no appetite, there was no movement to undertake the traditional Democratic norms, legislative norms anyway, of introducing legislation, having hearings about immigration issues, figuring out whether there was support for a wall, whether there was a way to fund the wall. And then we get to December, and the president decided that he wanted to essentially backdoor his way into a wall. And so the larger question is, what of divided government? What of the legislative process? And whether or not the American people will really accept the idea that if Congress has spoken and indicated that it chooses not to do something, a presidential administration can simply say, well, I don't care. I'm going to take money that's been appropriated to something else, and I'm going to use it for this priority. A priority, incidentally, which the president was very clear, would not be paid for by the American people, but would instead be paid for by Mexico.
Yeah, and just following up on Jamal's point, one of the reasons I say that this is essentially a political power struggle and it's not about the merits of the wall at all is just that timing. The president could have pushed for a wall at any time that he wanted in the last 2 years. He didn't. He had both houses of Congress under his control. Likely at that point, his popularity was at its peak, and that was his maximum opportunity to get a wall. He decided not to push for a wall until the Democrats controlled one house of the Congress, and that's why it appears that this is nothing more than a test of power between institutions. The question is going to be whether the legislature's jealousy of its own power, of its ability to control the purse strings and decide where the money goes, is going to override the short-term interest of 14 Republican senators in getting reelected and in being perceived as Trump supporters among their own constituencies. And that is the toughest question to predict.
A tougher question is the one William's about to ask. William from Belvedere, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. And I hope I might be able to make this adequately clear. The guest just said that it's basically a test of power between branches of government just now. There are people in government, particularly in the history of government, who have various views about the ascendancy of the executive, which branch should be more powerful, etc., etc. These are political theoreticians who think things out, and they're thinking in a large scope. I have to say that having observed President Trump over this period of time that he's been involved, I don't think he has the slightest idea or interest about the larger aspects of the ascendancy of the executive branch or the ascendancy of the congressional branch. I think it's just ego, and I would appreciate the guest's perspective on the perspective I offered.
William, thank you for joining us, and if you would, we're getting a little feedback, so I'd appreciate if you could take your answer on the air. But let me turn it over to my guest. What about that? Is William onto something here? It's really not about history or the law. It's all about ego.
Far be it from me to minimize the expanse of Donald Trump's ego. But having said that, what concerns me is that the classic scenario for undermining a republic is for the executive to arrogate to himself in one way or another emergency powers, usually during what he would characterize as a national emergency. And that's when and where Republican regimes turn into authoritarian regimes. Donald Trump certainly has a massive ego, but the other thing he does have and has shown time after time is a contempt for the notion of checks and balances and limits on presidential power. He has nominated two Supreme Court justices who made their careers writing about the essentially unlimited nature of executive power. And he's also shown an affinity for and a friendship towards authoritarian rulers. And he seems to like that style. So I think Donald Trump does have a huge ego, but because he has that huge ego, he would like to expand his power as much as possible and essentially assert unlimited power over American policy. And this, I think, is the first thrust in that campaign.
Jamal, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think we're talking about ego, or do you think there's really a threat to democracy?
Well, I think it very well could be a combination of both and other things as well. I would say to William's point and specific question, no, I don't think that this particular president has thought, broadly speaking, about the powers of the executive, nor do I believe that he's thought extensively about our democratic norms and institutions. I think that has been made apparent throughout the course of the past 2 years and certainly during the course of the campaign. I think that we, in some instances, do ourselves a disservice by normalizing the behavior of this particular president, trying to make the narrative of this presidency fit within the broader narrative of previous presidencies, which have generally adhered to a pattern of conduct that supports our democratic institutions. This is not a presidency that has done that. And so I don't know that we should necessarily go down the road of analyzing what this particular president might be thinking about various constitutional doctrines, such as the unitary executive theory, in terms of his leadership style. We should, however, continue to name a thing a thing. And so when we see certain tendencies displayed on the part of this president, we should call them out. And in the context of what is happening now with regards to the shutdown and the national declaration, it is very much a power grab, but I don't know that that power grab is rooted in the president's ideas about the presidency as much as they are in his desire to accumulate power.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
The topic tonight on Your Legal Rights, National Emergency 2019. I'm Jeff Hayden. In the studio with me, looking at the potential for an upcoming declaration of emergency, is Jamal Anderson, who has extensive experience on Capitol Hill before serving as a deputy San Mateo County District Attorney, and Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator, commentating on television and radio on both legal and political matters. While we may be discussing certain specific areas, we may be at a certain point in the conversation, call us regarding any comment or question regarding related to the topic we're discussing. We welcome your questions about nuts and bolts and how this system really works. The phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free. The number here is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. And let's divert a little bit away from our discussions of the president and talk about the history of national emergencies. Let's talk a little bit about what they are and how they work. Kind of give us a framework for a topic we're already pretty well invested in.
Well, yeah, national emergencies historically go back as early as Abraham Lincoln. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to actually issue a declaration of emergency during World War II when he wanted ships to sufficient ships to ship munitions to Europe. Virtually every president has declared a national emergency of one type or another. Most of them are regarding trading and economic issues with various countries. There are national emergencies regarding trade and freezing assets of North Korea and Iran, for example. But the historical pivot point was in 1976 when Congress or somebody working for Congress looked at all the statutes that give the president emergency powers and realized there were nearly 500. And a number of congressmen panicked at that point and said, you know, if a president just declared a national emergency and simultaneously invoked all of the powers that he could get under all of these emergency statutes, Congress would be out of business. We would be on our road to an authoritarian style of government. And so they passed the National Emergency Act, which requires the president now to specify a certain statute under which he is declaring the national emergency and to get funds as provided by that statute. Since that time, since 1976, we've had 42 declarations of national emergency under the National Emergency Act. 31 of those have just been renewed as a matter of course on an annual basis and are still in effect.
With that, let me turn it to Doris in Berkeley. You're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I just wanted to ask something. I'm going to read my notes for a change. Could it be that our president possibly has, I'm not a psychologist, but possibly has a dual personality situation whereby he wants to be seen as being super strong and in charge, okay? But at the same time, he also may create or be complicit, is that the word, complicit, in creating a situation whereby he has to yield to some level of compromise. Either way, his posture is that he is either super strong or he's the victim. And I think both approaches and both, shall I say, images appeal to his base. That's my thought. Is that your thought perhaps as well?
Well, my personal position is that I've given up on trying to psychoanalyze Donald Trump. I don't think it's a very productive undertaking. I prefer to look at the political issues that are coming up and the political struggles that are going on from a larger perspective. One of my favorite political scientists is a professor by the name of John Mearsheimer, who said that politics always expands to fill the space available. And I think that is what Donald Trump is doing. I don't think he thinks of it on a theoretical or philosophical level. He's just doing what politicians do, which is they try to maximize their power. And if they find a soft area or an empty area, which apparently he believes he has found in this Congress, they press to expand their power. If he's successful, then he takes a quantum leap. The executive branch takes a quantum leap in its power and influence. And people in Congress realize that, and they do the same thing. They attempt to expand or at least preserve their own sphere of power, and hence this struggle. And it is for this very reason, since this is a struggle that determines the role of two branches of government. And since it is the first such struggle that we have seen with this new Congress and with this relatively new president, neither side can ultimately give in, and neither side can compromise. Ultimately, this is going to be pushed to its ultimate conclusions, and somebody, one side or the other, is going to wind up as a big loser.
Well, Doris, I would say I want to stay away from the psychoanalysis, I should say. But I do want to speak to one broader point that you made, and that has to do with the president wanting to have it both ways. I think what we're seeing now with the new Congress, specifically with Democrats now in power in the House, is we are really seeing highlighted the extent to which the lack of experience of this particular president participating in government, understanding the legislative process, is manifesting itself. And the president is in a very difficult position for the first 2 years of his administration. I think what we saw was him trying to govern for the 40% or so of Americans who might be considered to be his base. And that seemed to be relatively effective, not legislatively, but relative effective in the sense of providing for them what he promised them on the campaign trail. He now has the new reality of an upcoming election. And I think he understands that he will not win re-election by simply continuing to appeal to this very narrow sliver of the American public. And so he is bending to the realities of our democratic institutions and of divided government in Congress, which hopefully he will do tomorrow. And I don't want to characterize that as a defeat for him, because we have two specific branches of government involved here, and they are doing the work that they're supposed to be doing, which is trying to figure out what is in the best interest of the American public. And not shutting the government down is in the best interest of the American people. However, the president also wants to continue to be able to go out to the people who supported him and say that he won. And so I think in so many ways that is why we are very likely to see an emergency declaration such that he can sign this legislation that he will say he disagrees with and doesn't like, all the while knowing that a shutdown does not benefit him, while at the same time going out to his supporters and saying that he did everything he could do to build a wall.
Yeah, let's just put it this way. Donald Trump has decided to engage himself in a battle with Nancy Pelosi in the Congress. And what Donald Trump doesn't understand is in this battle, he and his administration are the New York Knicks, and Nancy Pelosi is the Golden State Warriors, and she's playing on her home court.
Doris, thank you for joining us, and I hope that answers your questions. And with that, let me turn it to Karen, also from Berkeley. You're in the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, thank you. Good evening. Yeah, so since Donald Trump became president, the first day, everything has been a crisis that he's created. He's a perfect person to work as a provocateur, let's say, for Russia, because he pulled out of the Paris Peace Accords. He wants to get rid of NATO. He's lowering our standard in the world. And then he's destroyed the farming industry with these fake crisis tariffs on goods, government shutdown. Everything he's doing is not making America great, but he's working as hard as he can on behalf of who, to actually destroy America from the inside by making these phony crises everywhere, every time you turn around, and look what it's doing. I mean, no one's really talking about how the tariffs are affecting the farming community and you know, all over the world, where he just pulled out of the Russian interballistic treaty that Reagan signed with Gorbachev. I mean, he's pulling out of every single treaty.
Hey, Karen,
we appreciate your views, but do you have a question for my guest?
No, this is a comment.
Well, I appreciate that. If you could keep it kind of tight, because we have other calls waiting. We have four other calls waiting right now, and our time is pretty limited. So I appreciate your views, and I appreciate you joining us. If you could sum it up, I'd appreciate that. And I think we lost Karen. I'll turn it over to Jan and Hayward. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really concerned because I have great regard for the Fourth Estate, which is what you're doing tonight, but you're a rare exception. We're not getting the media that we need to rather than take profits from their advertising about Donald Trump, to really explain these issues to us clearly so that we all understand it. And I also would like to know, you know, Donald Trump has 30-40% of voters, but he has a tremendous amount of wealth behind him backing these policies, which truly disgusts me. They've bought the Republican Party and whoever else, but I don't think it's just Russians. It's Americans doing it as well. And I don't think we're getting enough information about all this sort of thing. And I would like to know just exactly what the American public can do about it that don't agree with this kind of way of taking our American democracy away from us.
Well, can I tell you what I've been doing about it? This is Dean. We have a site that I started about 5 years ago called punditnetwork.com, where we tap into the wisdom of people just like yourself in order to get reliable forecasts about what's going to happen in politics and in current affairs. That we see that as a weapon against fake news and alternative facts and the kind of alternative reality that Donald Trump is trying to create. And that grew out of my work in journalism for 12 years, where I, as a pundit, sat on anchor desks with people who had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. And you're absolutely right. Most of the people you see on TV who call themselves pundits are no more accurate about what they say than monkeys throwing darts at a dartboard. But you have, as you said, sitting here in this studio, three people who are trying to do everything they can to keep the public informed and to give you the straight message about what's really going on, and to also educate just a little bit about some of these issues that we know are complex and novel, and take you, guide you through that unexplored frontier that we're going into with Donald Trump.
And Karen, I appreciate the question, and I certainly understand the sentiment. You know, the short answer, I would say, is to vote. But I do believe that voting is really just a single part of the process of participating in our democracy. It seems to me that you're doing exactly what we want people to do, which is to be an engaged citizen, which includes consuming and questioning the news that you are reading and seeing. But it also means between the time of your voting, actively working to hold elected officials accountable for what they discuss on the campaign trail, and not solely at a federal level in terms of the President of the United States or members of Congress, but also at a state and local level. So many decisions that get made which impact people's lives are made at the local and state level. And in so many ways, what happens at the local and state level ultimately trickles up to the federal level. Many of the elected officials who we see in power now at the federal level started out as members of city councils, members of a state legislature, or statewide elected officials. And to the extent that folks can be active in helping to formulate and shape policies and get people elected that they support at the local and state level, you're likely to see outcomes that you may that may more align with your values at the federal level. So voting is certainly one thing to do, but it really includes being an engaged citizen between the time that you're voting, and there's so much to do with regards to that.
Yeah, I would join in that. But remember, what we're talking about tonight, to put this in perspective, is whether or not there should be $5.7 billion allocated to put up a wall to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
It's a product of the Donald Trump reality distortion field. It doesn't happen. It's a non-problem. And yet, probably 80-90% of traditional media is devoted to discussing whether we should allocate money to solve this problem. My suggestion to you is find news sources that you trust. There are a lot of news search engines out there and news scrapers that will allow you to read all points of view. And once you read all the points of view, learn to critically analyze what people on all sides are saying and come to your own opinion. We know from long, long studies behind that supported my founding of Pundit Network that people who do that, people who look at all points of view and learn to self-reflect and come to decisions on their own about what they believe, really come to very accurate decisions and accurate conclusions, and they're the most engaged, most informed, and most effective citizens.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Jen, thank you for joining us. And we'll turn it to Scott from San Francisco. You're on your legal rights. Welcome.
Thank you very much. There was a question or a discussion earlier about presidential emergency powers, and if it doesn't distract too much from the conversation directly about the wall, I think someone mentioned maybe like 31 executive emergency actions that are still in force, and I would be curious if the guests could mention a few of them that none of us know about and that all of us perhaps ought to be concerned about.
Well, I happen to have the list right here. Let's see. I'll give you a couple. Some of the declared national emergencies involve blocking Iranian government property, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, prohibiting transactions with terrorists who threaten to disrupt the Middle East peace peace process, blocking Sudanese government property and prohibiting transactions with Sudan. The list truly goes on and on. The greatest majority of them are restrictions on trade and declarations freezing assets with countries that we believe are acting contrary to American interests. There are a lot of restrictions that apply to Iran, Iranian property, trading with Iran, North Korea, and so on. But yeah, there are 31 national emergencies, 42 since the enactment of the National Emergency Act, some of which simply expired of their own terms. So national emergencies are not generally a big deal. What makes this one a big deal, and the reason we're talking about it, is this is the very first time that we see a president weaponizing national emergencies as an instrument of policy, where the only real emergency exists in the president's mind, and that emergency is that Congress happens to disagree with him.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate
that. Thank you for joining us. And from San Mateo, Joe, you're in your legal rights.
Yeah, hello. Okay, so you were talking about the re-election process. And one thing that came to my mind is the last time he ran, aside from the fact that many people didn't vote due to how they felt about the Democratic person, Hillary Clinton. Anyway, the situation is that the Electoral College, as I recall, had a big impact on him getting into office. And my question is, you were saying, one of you gentlemen were saying, that he can't hang on to the sliver of the population that falls under this whole fake news, build a wall, you know, jargon. The deal is that these states that have the most power with electoral colleges are the ones that he's pandering to all the time, and he's given speeches in that I can see. And I'm wondering if that's still going to have another effect on the reelection, because, I mean, aside from a popular vote, I mean, you know, that those are my ideas, and I just want to get your thoughts on that, because, you know, his base is, if it's something I don't agree with, it's fake news.
Well,
so it's really hard to believe.
I'll give you my thoughts on it, because I make a point of communicating with people back where I came from when I was a kid, many of whom are part of what we out here describe as the Trump base. And I can tell you, those people are passionate about Donald Trump. We talked about a reality distortion field. They live in that reality distortion field. They believe that we have a good economy because, as one of them said to me the other day, President Trump created that economy for us, and they're going to be very hard to shake. And in an election, it's not so much how many votes you get as what votes you get. If you get those swing votes in those swing states, if your votes are allocated correctly, you're reelected. And right now, as we stand here, putting Donald Trump out of office in the next election is going to be a tough row to hoe. So those who plan to, who hope to do that, whether they be in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, really need to start getting their act together. And frankly, my personal opinion, I don't see them doing that yet.
Well, Joe, I think you ask a very important question. You hesitated to mention Hillary Clinton. She did receive 3 million more votes, popular votes, than Donald Trump, but he was ultimately elected. I do think that we are heading into a very different time with the next election. In a lot of ways, the last election had issues at play that simply will not be at play, primarily because of the Democratic nominee. And so even though there is a built-in advantage for someone like Donald Trump with regards to states that are less populous, I do think we very well may have a very different election. And many of the voters, many of them independent voters who may not have voted for the Democratic nominee the last go-round, or who may have stayed home, may in fact participate after what they've seen go on over the course of the past 2 years.
Joe, one thing, and this is not my field, I'm a criminal defense attorney, but one thing that people don't mention is that in the 3 years leading into the last presidential election, the Republican Congress had ongoing investigations of who they saw as the heir apparent to the Democratic nomination. Hillary Clinton, and they were investigating her, turning over every rock they could to try to stir whatever enemy they could for her. By the time that that election came, she was an incredibly damaged and flawed candidate, and there's no equivalent to that taking place now. So presumably we'll have candidates that tend to stand on their own without this level of damage imposed upon them before they got there. But those are just my thoughts. Joe, thank you for joining us. We're really running low on time, but I appreciate your spending some time with us tonight. I would like to ask one last question. We only have about a minute or so, if we can keep it kind of tight. But what if the president entirely avoids declaring an emergency? Can he simply not write checks for whatever expenditures he doesn't like and simply take the money and spend it on the wall? He's made some statements about diverting emergency money and using it for what he considers an emergency, which is that putting up a wall, and somewhat for the fire victims and the like. Can he simply do that?
To a certain extent, yeah. There are statutes that are outside of the National Emergencies Act that simply allow the president to take money and use it at his discretion. And I think the president will explore some of that before formally declaring a national emergency. That certainly could happen. That certainly will happen. What I think is more likely, if the president decides not to go down the national emergency route, as some of his cohorts are recommending, is that he'll put what we've seen from time after time, he'll put the Donald Trump spin on it. He'll say, look, I got as much as I possibly can. Look at the national security budget. It's $23 billion. It's up 8% from last time. We squeezed them for everything we got. We got what we could. National security was enhanced as a result. I've done everything I possibly can. And to the extent that we've fallen short of my goals, that's on the Democrats. And then he'll proceed to blame everything that's done, every bad thing that is done by anyone who happens to be an undocumented immigrant, on the Democrats and their failure. It's all a matter of creating that reality distortion field and convincing people to live in the Donald Trump alternative universe.
And as a master of branding, he may go down just that road, but I'm afraid that's going to be the last word tonight because we've run out of time. I'd like to give you each no more than a minute to sum up if you'd like. Jamal, would you like to start?
Sure. I mean, I think what I was going to say is that there are always three questions that we find ourselves asking about decisions that this president makes. Can he? Will he? Should he? On this particular question, can he declare a national emergency declaration? Yes. Will he declare a national emergency declaration? It's likely, given the politics involved. Should he declare a national emergency? I think the answer to that is very clearly no. I think Dean has very well articulated that we don't necessarily find ourselves in a situation involving national security in the same way that we did with some of the examples that he cited. And beyond that, we have a Congress for a reason. We have a legislative process for a reason. And we should encourage our executive to go through the traditional legislative process and seek a compromise with them.
And Dean, how do you feel about that?
The wall is an absurd idea, but this is not about the wall. Historically, the first step that autocrats have taken in undermining republics is to declare a national emergency and grab power for themselves. That's been true since the time of the Roman Empire. Donald Trump has shown a clear disdain for the limits of presidential power, an affinity for the style of autocratic rulers, and it is for that reason that this particular issue is enormously important, and it is for that reason that our representatives in Congress cannot give in on this issue.
And with that, I would like to thank you both. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we've been looking at what to expect. Will the government be shut down once again? Will the president declare a state of emergency or simply find funds somewhere else in the budget? With me in the studio tonight, Emmy-nominated commentator and attorney Dean Johnson. And with extensive Capitol Hill experience, we have Deputy San Mateo County District Attorney Jamal Anderson. And Jamal, Dean, let me thank you both for joining us tonight.
A pleasure, as always. Thanks,
Thank you, Jeff, for having me.
Next week, we resume our discussion of the California Lemon Law with returning guest attorney and arbitrator Ron Rohde and consumer attorney and lemon law litigator John Hansen. In 2 weeks, a special program coming up. On February 27th, we will take a moment to reflect on the passing of Chuck Finney and the extraordinary year in which we have preserved his vision by keeping this program in operation. And yes, we invite your feedback on that show, you to share our vision for the show's future. And again, that's 2 weeks out. And February 27th will also be a Call a Lawyer night. Again, tonight you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. For production assistant Martin McLean and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.